we took average impressions and views from what was an average week of 5 million people, which is a lot for a brand without spending on media, up to an average 30 million per week. We delivered about 2 billion impressions over an 18-month period without putting our hands in our pocket on paid media.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment with me, Gary Fox. Today, we've got what I can only call a scoop. We've got Michael Corcoran, the ex-head of social at Ryanair, who left in explosive circumstances. We hear how he built one of the biggest social brands in the world, why he left, and what he does next. This is my talk with Michael Corcoran.
I've got a massive ambition for this podcast. I want to make this the number one business podcast in the world. If I'm going to do that, I've got to be world-class on every single level. And that includes having a world-class studio, which I now have at iconic offices, The Green Room. It's an incredible space. I first recorded here with my live pod back in June, and I loved it. And get this, it's publicly bookable. That means you can go online and book it right now. As I said, it's called The Green Room. It's a private cinema and screening room. That means it's perfect to wow a client with a pitch, host a private screening, or do what I do, record a podcast here. So, as I record here, and as you know, I'm a member of Iconic Offices, I've got the team at Iconic Offices to hook us up with a number of exclusive complimentary office trials and discounts for my audience for booking this exact space. No catches. Simply go to the web link in the description, grab the offer that works best for you. Thanks, Iconic Offices.
I'm building much more than a podcast with the Entrepreneur Experiment, and have a very clear vision of what I'm trying to achieve. One of those goals was to get involved in funding Irish businesses, and I've just achieved that goal. I've joined the Quintus Capital team as a special advisor to the EIIS Innovation Fund. I spent the last couple of years getting to know the team, learning about the industry, and the time has come to join forces. The EIIS Innovation Fund has invested in several of the podcast guests you know and love already, such as Matthew and Katie from Squid and Peggy and Crowley of Brown Wellbeing, which has made the decision to join the fund a really, really simple one. EIIS Tax Relief provides significant tax refunds to investors who back Irish SMEs. However, the main issue with EIS is finding the right companies to invest in. This is where the EIS Innovation Fund comes in. It has an experienced management team to allocate your capital. They're now raising capital for November and December to deploy in 2024. If you are interested in becoming an investor, please visit EIIS.fund, so EIIS.fund, or download a copy of the online brochure in the show notes. Ever find yourself jumping from task to task? Sudden eureka moments at the weirdest hours, and you forget little details? Does that sound familiar? That might be ADHD, and ADHD Now are here to help. Their experienced clinical professionals conduct video consultations at your schedule and help you manage and understand these symptoms, turning them into your unique assets. Visit adhdnow.ie/fox and use the code FOX10 at checkout for 10% discount on your initial consultation and full assessment.
Michael, welcome to the pod. I've always wanted to say this. What a scoop.
What a scoop.
What a scoop.
Oh, the tea is being spilled everywhere. We don't know what's going on, but something's happening. You have somebody who's not even a founder, who doesn't have a pot to piss in his life, talking on an entrepreneur podcast. Why the fuck am I here, Gary?
But you know, we'll figure that out. It'll all reveal itself over the course of the next hour. But you're a managing partner now.
I am. It's a wanky term, but we had to give something to...
LinkedIn, right?
Yeah, something for the LinkedIn. But even at that, I'm going to take the piss out of myself.
What were you doing before you were a managing partner, Michael?
Again, I'm in a bit of an echo chamber, so like I'm getting my ego massaged and rubbed way too much over the last couple of years. I am or have been the head of Ryanair social media and content for about 2.5 years. I came in there in about July 2021 off the back of some interesting career movements. Another one is after happening too. But I was given the responsibility of putting a strategy together for Ryanair that could work in the space. Assembling a team of misfits, which I did, a beautiful bunch of human beings, and try and make Ryanair famous on the internet.
Well, fucking mission accomplished there.
So people say, but again, I'm my typical self. We live in this marketing echo chamber that I'm getting a lot of compliments from, but there were signals outside of what is good social media marketing that it carry true and cut through to actual real people who talk about it all the time. And I think it worked.
Well, why we're here, not to massage your ego further, is we were at Ecom Live together last year.
and you were on just after me. I warmed them up for you. Then you came on and finished the deal.
What do you call them? Fluffers? Is this a character?
I wasn't going to use the term, but then there you go. There, you can say whatever you want.
There's no PC with me.
So I normally, and I said this to you earlier, I normally would just like bolt. It'd be over. But I was like, this could be pretty good. I'll hang around. And it really bloody was. Not to massage your ego even more, but it was a bloody brilliant talk. We'll get to the topic of that talk in a minute. You mentioned before you were in Ryanair. What were you doing?
So I would have been agency side for in a couple of agencies in the company of Huskies, who are now absolutely blown out of the water. And like, I'm so proud of the work that they've done. But I started my career there. They gave me my shot. And I came in actually on an internship. And within 4 weeks, they offered me a full-time role because they saw something in it. Jonathan Forrest, MD there, who's been a great and huge, great people. I was there for about 3 or 4 years, but I decided I needed to take a step up. And there was, again, I wasn't getting the growth opportunity, also the financial opportunity. So I went looking elsewhere. I took on a role then with 8020, which was an independent agency here as well, but they got bought minority by WPP. Dave Connor would have founded that and set that up many moons ago. Worked there on some great accounts like Aldi, Guinness Storehouse, Opel, and many, many others. But during that transition, I found it an interesting thing because when I went back to Huskies and I told them I got an offer, the first thing Jonathan said was, congratulations. And he said, there's one piece of advice that I'd always give you is always know your market value. And I found that fantastic. He was so transparent and so honest, knowing that we know your potential. We can give you that growth and development here, but we can't monetize that right now because we're in a period of growth. And he was very clear on what that was, that we can't increase your salary level. But here's where we can go. I probably know that's not going to match what you've got. But that's at least that I have. I eventually got the decision where I left, but you know, between that advice, it kind of really set me up for success. And when I did navigate my career, and even when I installed the people I manage and the people I talk about, is I always tell them, always know your market value. Always know in business, it's business. Mm-hmm. You're still an employee at the end of the day, and there's always going to be something out there where people will hold a better value for what you provide. The other thing, like what caused it as well, is there's two kind of things that drive your satisfaction, especially in work. And this is strange because like entrepreneurism is quite different. But again, I'm talking as, I guess, climbing the corporate ladder. There's two things that kind of motivate you in work. It's growth and it's money. And it's almost like a scale. If you're getting good growth, but you're not earning enough, you know there's satisfaction that this is going to provide the opportunity for my next step. So I'll sit tight. If you provide money, but you know it's a solid job, but there's no growth or there's no development, it's okay because after my working hours, I have a pretty good life. If one of those outweigh the other, there's a nice decision to be made. So you can stay there longer. You understand that there's a value transaction there. But if both of them down, big red flag, it's time to go. And it was kind of like that at the moment in what I thought was, were in my first role, that I wasn't getting the growth potential and I wasn't getting the money and I needed to make a decision. And it was at that time when I weighed those up those options and used that scale as a metric. It was the right thing to do. But went to 80-20 for a number of years, worked there. And once I was finished agency side and been whipped by every brand that possibly can, because that's what agencies are there for, I moved in-house and I went to the wonderful world of Paddy Power Betfair. Now, whenever I mention that, people think, oh, you're the guy behind Paddy Power. No, I'm not. I'll never take credit for that. Michal Nagel is the guy behind Paddy's Power Social, head of social, and he should take the credit. So if anybody ever listens, I try to clarify that and rectify that. It's just the name of the business at the time was Paddy Power Betfair. That came first. I would have managed the Betfair brand. It was more of a premium betting brand, more dominant in the UK market. And I was the innovator of building the Betfair Exchange. I would have worked there for about 3 years or so. Again, trying to define and improve their social media. But that came with really interesting challenges too, both in identifying what that was in the shadows of Paddy Power, who were doing such exceptional work on social media, and finding out their why. Didn't come to the fruition that I would have hoped. Did we do some great work? Yes, we had a lot of budget, a lot of investment, created lots and lots of content, but there was some great learnings in that experience of what not to do. when it came to actually winning in this space. Long story short, then I got to a stage where there was a big reorg in Flutter, and sadly I was one of the people who were putting the list of people to go, because there was a global setup. They needed to break it down into different markets, so anybody working in the global roles were no longer null and void, and they were merging roles into two. Brand and social came together. I'm a social guy. I've done social media since day dot. I understand the theory of marketing and branding? I do. I apply it in everything that I do every day. But I knew I only had 20% of what that role was. They still encouraged. I went for it and I said, you guys are laughing. I know we're just going through the motions here, but the guy beside me who's my colleague is far better suitable to that fucking role than I will ever be. So I went, okay, I'll go to the motions, but I knew what the answer was. Eventually stepped out. We're getting there.
Pause for 1 second. You said you learned not what to do. I'm going to come back to that in a few minutes. I want you to explain what not to do, but go on ahead.
Great. Last piece of the puzzle then is I had no work. I was given a nice little golden handshake to go out the door, and I went, what next? Euro 2020 came to town. So I went and worked with UEFA for a small stint, which is one that I don't speak about actually a lot, because it wasn't the purest traditional social role. If all honesty, it was great for the CV.
What were you doing?
I was a fan communications coordinator.
Fancy.
So that would have been all the comms that was pushed through the Euro 2020 app around going to the games. I was responsible for the execution of that within the Dublin legs of the game. But long story short there, COVID happened, we lost the matches, it went out. But because I had such a good experience and it did so well, they kept me on for the remainder of the tournament working remotely, which was a fantastic thing to
Unreal.
Do at that time. So
class.
It was
especially
great.
If you're a sports fan.
Oh, big time, definitely. And it was a great experience. Not directly connected to what I was doing purist in social media for many, many years, but it's always one I forget about. Like when you talk about it, Euro 2020 is one of the biggest footballing events around the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, why don't you ever remind people that you actually worked there for 8 months? When that was done, I went to look for a next option. I saw a Ryanair gig come up. It said you have a carte blanche responsibility of transforming Ryanair social media. I got interviewed. It took 30 minutes to do the interview and I got the offer the next day.
What did you say?
I don't know really. I again, what appealed to me in the conversation was the lack thereof of bullshit. And we had a very frank conversation on what was done. My CV was my CV. I didn't really need to talk about it. You can read that. I explained why I liked the business. I explained why I wanted to work there. I felt that it was an opportunity for me to work in an environment that culturally, or so I thought, was right. And I got the gig. And within 6 months...
What was their social at the time? Because I think only people listening will remember what it is now. But what was it at the time?
Like, again, they've always been okay at it. Like, it was took a while for them to evolve it. There was peppers of winnable moments that got them attention. The tone of voice was kind of always there. But I think when COVID happened, the team got kind of broken apart. Like, when travel wasn't happening, you couldn't really communicate about travel. And what they were doing was quite a mix-mash, fragmented, chaotic, trying to be like what other airlines were on the internet with a little bit of dabble of humor put in. So there was sparks of the potential of a success, but there was no clear strategy behind it and no clear process or plan behind it either. And I literally took that and I supercharged it. Now, the other thing I can't take credit for, which again, I'm very honest, is I didn't make Ryanair TikTok what it is today. Did I take it over and help accelerate it more? To an extent. But the team beforehand, Andrew Mython is his name, and Lily Rafferty, who was there for about a year of my time, were the people who were the main drivers of what success that most people would be the original reference point to Ryanair Social before kind of blew up everywhere else. I think during COVID they had an opportunity because TikTok became this comfort blanket for everybody on the internet. It was this place where, you know, everyone was so sick of this fake filter nature of social media that, you know, they wanted realism, and TikTok became the space where it was. And it's predominantly driven by the Gen Z demographic because they're sick of fake shit on the internet and they want to be real and honest about things. They want to be self-deprecating, and even the traumas that they live through and the traumas to the world, and they use dark humor as a way to, you know, navigate that. And TikTok became this place for it. And at the time, because Ryanair couldn't talk about travel, they just let the team have a go at it, test and learn, do and fail things fast, and the things that most other corporate brands are still only trying to figure out now. And they got an opportunity, they got out there fast, and the rest was history for them.
What was your strategy? What did you go in and say, right, this is what I'm going to do?
There was a lot of observation at first. And look, when it comes to strategy, I try to put a bit of shape and a framework. And again, essentially what I'll do going forward in my career next is I need to understand the why. I need to find what is the opportunity. And that's built on kind of four variables. You've got brand, category, customer, and the social media landscape. And from that, you start to build the information, build the insight. What is ownable or what is unique to the brand? From a category point of view, what is happening in the category that everybody's doing that you might find a point of difference to do different on the internet? Customer, what are the customer's motivations, needs, wants, or problems that you need to try and solve? And the last one, well, what do people look for when it comes to content on the internet? What is the current landscape like? How is it going to evolve? And it's finding intersections and points on that that then makes the best informed decision. And when you start to find that, you then identify your why. You can see what that is, how it can do something for the brand or business, and how you can have impact. And more importantly is you start to make decisions on what not to do. Mm-hmm. Because we always talk about strategy as a way of what to do. But strategy is also about sacrifice. And it's about making decisions about what not to do. And the biggest problem most corporate brands and people have when it comes to using these platforms, which are already so chaotic and so fragmented, is it becomes this big fucking dumping ground of shit for everyone. And it's just every person wants a tick box on their PowerPoints to say that they've delivered on their campaigns or messaging by just sticking it on social media. And that's the first problem, because you not only do you need to compete with people on the internet, you're competing against other people within your business with other messaging. And it's completely cannibalizing you before you even think about how you compete with other people.
That's a lot.
It is. I can talk a lot too.
How do you translate that into what you did?
So if I can try to distill it, like the main brand insight that came for us was Ryanair democratized travel. Back in 1985, Ryanair came to the market and completely flipped the script. Travel was a luxury back then. Anybody trying to travel would pay an arm and a leg, and it wasn't a commodity or wasn't accessible to all. Ryanair came and changed. Say, let's take flights from London to Dublin by British Airways or Aer Lingus, our national carrier. It was about £300 at the time. Ryanair came in £50. Everybody got to travel and see the world. They disrupted the category, and then they disrupted it through their marketing. Again, I will not take credit for something that was already being done so well previous. The CEO himself, Michael O'Leary, knew that low-cost, high-reach marketing was a very effective way to build awareness for the brand, but you had to do it in a way that was disruptive. And he lived and died that, and still to this day does it, for good or for bad. And it was in our DNA. So knowing that that was something that was associated with us, but not everybody knew it was associated with us, because you've got demographics who wouldn't know of Michael O'Leary or wouldn't have experienced it, but they were the two kind of main things. We knew that we were disruptors. We can be polarizing as a brand because we've done it from day one, and we can polarize in what we say and what we do, and it's of nothing new. Second then is in the category. Everyone is doing the same thing when it comes to communication. They're selling these fake filtered experiences, beautiful pictures of cabin crew, these destination shots all the time, and it's all aspirational. And yeah, it's going to deliver some sort of reach and engagement, but it's modest. And by doing the same thing, you're going to fail. It's just jumping into the sea of sameness, this vanilla corporate bullshit that corporate brands have been doing for many, many years, thinking that that's the right thing. So then we go to the customer. The biggest insight for the customer was passengers' expectations are too high when it comes to traveling low cost. And that's played out predominantly on social media. There's first world problems. There's luxuries that they think that they can expect for getting a 10-hour flight to the UK. And the problem wasn't necessarily with the boomers.
Why does that persist?
Who knows? Silver spoons. The Celtic Tiger babies is what I think it is. It's the boomers don't have a problem. We democratize travel. They knew about that. And they're okay with the things that they're...
Because they knew what it was like. They knew it's going to be £400 and now it's 40. And, happy days. And get on, be quiet.
There's things I'm not going to get when I would pay for £400, but that's okay because I pay £40 to get from Dublin to Malaga, single fare. Then you've got the young generation who are tech savvy, who know it, who are very cost sensitive, who just want experiences to do crazy shit. They can go on a flight to Italy and have a pizza and come back the same day for £20. Why? Because they fucking can. You have the silver spoon millennials, the jackasses like me, all my friends who think, who expect luxury across everything because we're so fucking privileged that their expectations are too high. And they complain and complain and complain and complain all the time, even though they paid fuck all for their ticket. And there was a big problem we had to change, because most of that moaning and those first world problems were being played out on social media first before everywhere else. And not only on social, but then in the conversations they were having with our friends and peers. And we needed to do something about that. The last one then is the landscape. The two main motivations, and I will not ignore this, and I won't. And unless you're talking about paid campaigns, which is paid advertising, which is different, I'll talk about like the organic opportunity, even I hate using that fucking word. Is the two main motivations people go to social media at the moment. One is to be entertained, and two is to escape from the shit show that's going on in their day-to-day lives. And other than that, if you don't cater to those first, you're losing a battle straight away. Again, so everything you need to wrap around in is in that. And even at that, though, that escapism is small pockets of opportunities where somebody is working a 12-hour shift and they're very busy. It's probably not the most aspirational or enjoyable job. And I'm talking about the majority here. They go to the toilet. They're spending 5 minutes on the toilet. They are on their commute. They're spending 30 minutes on their bed. It's small pockets of active consumption, but yet so much content by the category, by everyone, has been created that is very passive and doesn't meet the needs, wants, or motivations that people look for on social. And you then try to create that content that is just not working. And then you've got to match it between content that other creators are making that is fun, entertaining, engaging. The other shite that then your sister's putting up that she had brunch in fucking a bar with bottomless mimosas. Your granny's putting up a picture of her dog after walking. And all this you're competing with. And if you don't understand the basic needs and wants and motivations of social media, you're going to bloody lose. So by putting all those together, we looked at, okay, who's doing a really good job? Creators. What is appealing to people? Entertainment-driven content. Talking about the shit that's going on in the world in a way that is self-deprecating. And it's done in a way that isn't polished. Fantastic. So let's think and act like a creator. And then how does that work for us? Well, we are a low-cost airline. We don't overinvest in marketing. We're not premium. We don't position ourselves to be. And we've got a polarizing tone of voice. Handshake. Perfect match. We can now do this very easily. How does it work against our competitors? Well, we're not doing premium content talking about experiences. We're talking about the problems in the point of view of passengers and people that makes it more relatable and less aspirational. And the final piece is, within that content and messaging, we are finding ways to change the perception around traveling low cost by leaning in so much on ourselves and the product and the process. By leaning into the first world problems, we're almost making it aware that we know the experiences you have. But that's the product. Get over it. It's a point-to-point airline, a bloody good one at that. And all you're paying for is getting from A to B as close on time as possibly can for sweet fuck all. And we leaned in on that. And with all that insight, we created an articulation of a strategy.
Because what you're saying there is very fucking simple, but not easy.
But that's strategy.
So is that easy? Everyone would be doing
that. But that's strategy. It's going to the point of finding where the opportunity lies and trying to articulate then what that is in the best way possible. And then putting a set of guiding principles together about where you are now to where you need to get to next. Not necessarily hard and fast rules, but navigation points that allows you to have consistency and focus to try and get you moving along, to have impact and to do something that actually could work. And even like, not all strategy is perfect either, like, but at least it's a set of decisions of what to do and what not to do and how to get there.
So that was your strategy. Execution. How?
Execution. So we did a creator-led approach. So we acted and behaved like a creator on the internet. And we had two levers that did it. One was to be relatable and topical when it comes to what's happening in the world and being a voice. And that translated from what we were doing in the past, our CEO talking about the things that are going in the world in a provocative way, but it was still entertainment. And then delivering always on content that changed the perception of traveling low cost. And what we did was we called it like a jab, jab, hook approach. That every time we hit a jab with reactive content that, again, I don't want to use the word, that got traction, generated PR, the V word, viral. Millions of impressions. It created a window of opportunity for us. Yes, at the very basic principles of marketing, we created mental availability, awareness of the brand. Ryanair, Ryanair, Ryanair. And if you can do that, that's half the battle of marketing. We then also, in that opportunity, like again, I'm not going to say I know how the algorithms work because that's bullshit. Nobody knows. Not even the algorithms know themselves. The computers don't even fucking know. They're teaching themselves. But what I can have a fair assumption on is that when a piece of content goes viral, you reach a lot of low engaged users. And there's an opportunity where if you engage with that content, you're sending some sort of signal to the machine that you like this content. So they're either going to share more of the content from the same account or similar content from that same niche or area to see, do you like more of it? And if you continuously engage with it, you're on to a winner. So with that jab, jab, hook approach, like when we hit people with the reactive content, we knew we had a small window to re-engage them. So we needed to make sure that the rest of our content are always on, let's call it. The really important message perception changing content.
What do you mean by always on? What does that mean?
Always on is pre-planned content. So always on is content that's pre-planned that is ran on a daily basis. So it's planned, it's coordinated, there's a process to it, there's a frequency to it.
Like what?
Like what? So it's, we would have delivered video content across, say, a working week. We deliver 10 pieces of video content across a number of channels. And in that is a specific set of messages that changed perception around first world problems, that helped generate awareness of the low-cost model, that tapped into relatable moments around traveling and traveling low-cost and traveling in the air. And in that, we baked in messaging about the plan, the process, the carrying to change the mindset of traveling with low-cost. So always on is that frequent messaging that you need to deliver creatively with repetition that allowed to change a mindset. Whereas reactive is impulsive. It's off the cuff. It's never planned because you're spotting moments to actually execute on.
And these are probably the moments people are thinking of right now.
That's the moments people are doing. But funnily enough, the always on is the stuff that has really shifted the dial. Yes, people are aware of us for being an entertaining brand, but the pain points are the areas where they want, or where we wanted people to hate Ryanair less. It's the always on content that has been a real game changer on that. And we took average impressions and views from what was an average week of 5 million people, which is a lot for a brand without spending on media, up to an average 30 million per week. We delivered about 2 billion impressions over an 18-month period without putting our hands in our pocket on paid media.
2 billion, let's just emphasize that. 2 billion organic reach, not paid.
Not paid. Now, that's excluding. That's only what we can quantify on the dashboards on the channels that we manage. That's not including any of the articles written or the publicity driven by media on the back of the content we made, and there was a lot. The screenshots and the using of our content by meme accounts, the likes in the UK, the Archbishop of Banbury, the British memes, who have millions and millions of followers, who countless times took our content and published it. If you use the old wanky PR metric of, you know, a mention or an image on a piece of editorial is worth three times the ad value or three times the reach. You take the 2 billion and multiply that by three. That's potentially, again, I'm not going to say that's what we did, but the impact that it had and the amount of people it reached.
That's like mental. And I think it's important. That's when I was listening to your talk, I was like, holy shit. Because people don't really understand the scale of what you were doing.
With a team of 7 people, all done in-house by ourselves. But what was important to that? It was navigating, was finding the right people to execute in the strategy. It was putting the plans and processes in place. It was creating the creative playgrounds to unearth and train and condition to those moments of success that we got. Because they weren't one-off moments. There were sometimes there were moments of luck and things mixed up. But that was off the back of conditioning, repetition, training, finding efficiencies, building processes in place to make sure that we can maximize our time and our ability to make sure that we are always on the clock when it comes to reactive, but we're still delivering a high frequency and threshold of always on content that was meeting every time we hit those moments. And both of them working side by side led to that growth impression of 2 billion.
Like, it's so rare to do that, I think. Consistently. All right, people can go viral once.
Yeah.
You know, lightning can strike. But to do it consistently.
You build a reputation for it, though. And that's what came off the back of it as well. We built a reputation for when something happened in the world. Who's going to be talking about this in an entertaining way?
So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. People would come and go, what are they going to say next?
Pretty much, and they were waiting.
Right.
And also, because they were engaging so much, there was a higher chance we were being served faster. Then there's also our timing. Like, our timing and our speed of reacting was incredibly important. And timing, even if an idea is half good, or a funny interaction to a moment that's happening in the world is, you know, average. First to market is always really, really important in the world of social because, you know, you'll get the early engagement that carries and you'll break through then and reach more people, the low engaged users, and start appearing those feeds, and it takes off even further and further. So, like, there's so many things that you can break down in detail about how we did it. But timing, having the team set up to be operating in a specific way to make sure that we always had somebody one eye on the pulse. And then we also had a very lean and smart operation to producing high volume content. Like we were delivering maybe, I'd say it's about 60 pieces of pre-planned content every week. And that's including a lot of video. And that takes time to concept, to produce, to plan, while still delivering in the world of reactive and being on the clock all the time.
That sounds like a mountain of work, especially for a small team like that. How are you managing it?
It is, but like we broke it into two tribes or two squads, whatever language you want to use. One was reactive and community. It did what it said in the tin. They were the news checkers. And the agreement was that in each tribe, 50% of your time was dedicated specifically to that discipline. So we made sure there was like 4 and 4. Even myself, I got involved in the early stages because I had to teach and coach about how to do it. Like, again, these were people who were coming in quite raw. Basically, the 50% time was on it. But you had then 4 people which in each team. So whilst they might have been working on other projects or doing other things, we always had people on the clock for reactive. We then did discovery work. So we always had like 2 discovery moments every day. We had an AM check and a PM check where we use Twitter, we use Reddit, and we use other touch points to find what's happening out there in the internet. We compiled it, we shortlisted it, and we then put it into a working group where we started to then ideate on the go. In that person who was in discovery should at least have starter ideas or starter for tens on those concepts to make us move faster or even go yes, no, and fast track the decision making. And in each moment...
So you're trying to find something just on the cusp of going viral?
Just on the cusp of going viral.
And then you're trying to put your spin on it. So you have someone always watching, going, here, right, here's our top 5. This is what's bubbling. This is what I think will bubble. And this is what I think we could do with it.
Correct. And if there's a starter idea, which means we can move faster. If not, well, then we put it in, we put 5 minutes on the clock. And again, 5 minutes on the clock. If you don't have an idea that we feel meets the criteria.
So you're in a meeting room. What are you doing?
It's not in a meeting room. It's all in chat or around our desks.
Unreal. 5 minutes on the clock.
Minutes on the clock. And it's literally we tissue. And if we can make it in 5 minutes, even better. If we can't make it, we'll allow a little bit more time if we think it's a runner. And then we go. If it's past 5 minutes and we're over engineer, overthinking, it's not going to work. We miss the moment. Next play. We move on. And we did that kind of 2 core checks every day. AM and PM, but in the day we would have then obviously things we keep an eye on, things we know might happen, things that happen during a day that we know will take, like Prime Minister's questions in the UK, where we knew Wednesday at 12 o'clock Sky News is on, we're always watching that because normally something really golden comes from there, especially when Boris Johnson and Liz Truss was in as Prime Ministers at that working time. It was just absolute content gold, and we knew public affairs was an open game for us because everybody loves talking about it, everyone loves shitting over, and we absolutely tore the arse.
And you're always punching up.
Correct.
Always punching up.
So then we go to the other side, which is always on. The other half of the team, same. 50% of their time was dedicated to production of always on content. So we reach a threshold where we needed to meet, say, 10 pieces of video creative that were reels, reels and friendly and YouTube shorts. So portrait video, contextual entertainment, almost pre-planned sketch comedy, which is also jumping into more responsive, not reactive trends, things that were happening at the moment, whether it was a trending sound or a trending moment or a trending thing on the internet, and we put our spin on it. And then there was kind of pre-scripted ideas, comedy and sketches within our content that became video memes. Then we looked at static as well. So we made sure that we weren't only catering to video, but we were catering to static, so the meme worlds, and tapping in and finding relatable moments. Again, finding captioned images that were relevant at that moment in time or things that we knew that would be able to articulate a message that was important for us. We did like 10 of those. Why 10? We just agreed that based on time, resource and budget, we had to reach a certain frequency of that. Now, that takes a lot of time to ideate, create, and make at the same time. So whilst the content looks lo-fi and purposely looks lo-fi, it still takes time. But what we ended up doing, we started to create a method. We said, we'll go with 10 first. Funny enough, on a different podcast, I said there was no science to this, but they said, when you explain it, there is a fucking science to it.
Everything you do is a clear system in science. Like this sounds like you're part comedian, part CEO, part MBA, part everything. Like you're just... art and science blend complete.
But again, no matter what I do, if I make coffee, if I smoked out sheds on a farm, I'd still probably be the same. I'd be relentless, curious, and I'd just try and do my best. But when it came to the always on, we said, well, what's a threshold? Let's try 10 pieces of creative. So we said, we need to make sure as a team in the always on tribe, you need to deliver 10 pieces of video creative and 10 pieces of static creative the Friday in advance of the following week. However we get there, that's your target. So we started to go through it, took weeks and weeks, failed, missed the deadlines. Again, this is a new team.
So you're looking ahead, week ahead. This is what's going to happen. England are playing whoever. We're going to have an announcement. There's an election, blah, 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 blah,
exactly,
blah.
Exactly, and map. Even just pain points. And it's just relatable content to to the travel model, to the low-cost experience, tapping into those moments. People complaining on the stairwell. Why the fuck are we standing on the stairwell? Well, let's make a joke out of that, but explain why at the same time. So all that content was done in advance. So they were working on, and we built process around from concept to production, to edit, to review, to approve. And the aim was to have those 10 pieces, of, or let's say 20, the static and the videos, done 1 week in advance. We eventually got to that. It took a long time to get there. And we got there. And then we started to look, okay, what was good? What was sticky? We tested, learned, we iterated the creative. We let the audience decide what was good and what was not. And we hit a threshold. We said, right, 100,000 video views. Again, people laugh. 100,000 video views. If I got that for any piece of content, we'd be promoted, bonuses everywhere. But that to us was our benchmark, our foundation. So as we hit that, we saw that, okay, we take that content and we put it into what's called a banger bank. Because this is another misconception with social media. And there's this old age thing created by agencies for so many years and just pisses me off that they feel you have to be 24/7 on social media to deliver a win. Yes, to an extent, if an organic play is what you're doing. But the production of that content equals money. And that's what content agencies and agencies have been doing for ages. And they've been creating this falsehood that this is the only way you can win on social, but it's not. That's another tangent I can go on. But essentially what we got to was that we wanted to create enough content that was hitting the mark, that was sticky. And we then, once it was sticky and it was reaching a threshold of performance, we put it into our banger bank because we knew we could use it again and we knew it was good. Now, I'll tell you why, and I'll give you a great example.
You that opened my eyes to this. You were the first person I heard say this.
And I love this as well because like this, if you went to a brand or if you went to an agency came and said, we need 250 grand to make a TV ad. Okay, that sounds about right what it costs to make a TV ad. But we're only going to air it once on TV and it'll never be seen again. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, marketing needs to be run with frequency. You need to deliver that message numerous of times to people so they can get recall, either remember the message, remember the brand, or have some sort of connection or remember what you're trying to say. But yet for some reason on social media, oh, let's make a monthly calendar with 30 pieces of content. Let's put it out there, but let's never use it again because it's not fresh enough. It's all just out of date. Bollocks.
As if everyone is just waiting to see your piece, your one piece you're going to put out that day.
Nobody sees.
And you said like the algorithm. Sure, Jesus, sometimes the algorithm doesn't serve it. It serves it to the wrong thing. Or it's testing.
Because it doesn't even meet the mark. It's not like it's shit content. It's a price point in a fucking product. But where I'm getting to is we eventually then when we delivered, we created the system. We started to get ahead. We started to build the always on system. And then we were happy enough that the bank was full enough. We then started to bring the bank back into our weekly planning. So rather than making 10 new pieces, we made 8 and took 2 from the bank and put it into the mix and send it again. And we started to improve. As that grew, the number of views grew on that content yet again. So our threshold went up. We hit a threshold of 150,000 video views. Then we went, great. We tested, we were continuously learning and testing the creative and we were continuously building the bank. Then we got to a point where we were making 8 or 6 videos and putting in 4. Then we were getting down to 4 and then putting in. Now we could focus on quantity, or quality, not quantity. And our creative was getting better. Our ideas were getting better. And then we started conditioning. And we had this bank and we were cycling content all the time.
Because people think it's one or the other. Oh, I just have to lash it out or I'm going to do one unbelievable one thing a week. Can't be one or the other.
No. And this is only one side of how to do social, by the way. And like a big thing for me is like Ryanair are the exception in what social media was, both their tone and how they deliver. But it's not the norm. But it's not also the only way to deliver. We took a very kind of media publisher, content creator approach. That was the strategic decision. But there's plenty of brands that don't even need to touch that at all. Not even do organic at all. They could do pure play. They could do influencer. There's so many ways to be on social without being on social in the traditional sense. But we set up the teams to deliver that and we created the vehicle. So now it looks like, okay, so you created a system now that became more leaner, more efficient, reusing content, making the content better, QAing it, improving it. And this cycle happened. This beast became a thing and it became on autopilot. So then not only did we focus on the quality of less video content we were making, it freed up our time then to look at what are the other things we can win within social. And it became more efficient and we're using our time better. And the two of them working together created the beast that we did.
And then what happened?
And then they go and spoil it all by saying something stupid like... what happened? Great question. Where do I start? Off the back of the good work we were doing at Ryanair, I got asked that I wanted to take on a more expanded role in taking over the creative department. And I said, this is a great opportunity because I set myself a deadline of 2 years that I need to make this work where I'm no longer needed. And that's a success for me. because it pushes me to take my next step. Because I was head of social for nearly 6 or 7 years across different roles and different remits. I reached my ceiling there. I needed something else. I need to expand.
So you said 2 years, I'm going to be gone out of the head of social role into what?
Something, either in there something. Or elsewhere.
Right.
But that was my, July 2023 was my target. Wasn't far off it. And I made a commitment to the senior person I hired as well. I said, my job is to put you in my seat in a year's time. I said, if you come and commit, I will get you there. I got her there in January 2023, where I then took on a wider remit. I tried to then reshape the creative department.
What's creative department?
In-house design studio. So video production, they would have designed all the emails, all the internal comms, all the own channel work, the branding, the airport branding, all of that. We had a studio of about 16 people. I took on that and it became almost, I think 18 or 19 people, and we're still hiring at the time. But at that time, I said, look, I'll take this on. I have no problem. This is a great growth role for me. This is me expanding creativity. I thought that there was a bigger opportunity then for Ryanair to take what we learned and what we did in social media and bring it through all the marketing, which the business were actually buying into. However, I made a comment at that time, but I can only do it if I see a change in how our boss, our director, was engaging and behaving and communicating to the team, which I felt was an unacceptable way. And I got commitment at the time that I would see changes. I said, fine. But I said, if there wasn't, there was going to be a problem at some point. I won't be sticking around. Long story short, we got to a point where an incident happened where one of my team was impacted and I just couldn't stand over it anymore. So I decided to take it further. And I then resigned because I wasn't happy with the process of how it happened. And I wasn't convinced in the changes that were being said were going to happen. There was the word saying that change will happen without articulating what that change is. And there wasn't enough substance in that for me to change. So I resigned. And then within 24 hours, I was given a beautiful letter to go on gardening leave. And here I am. So I officially finished after 3 months gardening leave. Obviously, I couldn't say, do anything, work with anybody, but I had plenty of time to talk to lots of people about what next. I thought I'd make that decision in 2 weeks' time, or in 2 weeks after I left on gardening leave. But the amount of calls, curiosity, desire to work.
You're very good at what you do. You're able to just peek just a little.
Well, like I kind of knew, like, and again, without being too arrogant, the reason why I stepped forward and I couldn't stand over the behavior anymore and why I did it is I knew I had nothing to lose. I knew we built a bit of a beast within the industry that created a very good reputation for myself and my team because it was the team. We all did the work. And I knew that was a great platform for whatever we all wanted to do.
I think you've been a bit unfair on yourself there. I mean, to step away from any role is a massive risk, but I think it takes a lot of principle and a lot of character. And I think that's partially why the reaction you're getting now. You're not a man that takes flattery kindly. I can see that. But, you know, we always have something to lose, and to walk away from something that is a massive success you've built. Everyone's looking at you going, he's a great lad. They're a great team. You know yourself. Not easy to replicate what you've done once, right?
No, and nor did I want to walk away. I saw that growth opportunity as another 2 or 3 years to now, how can I blow this out across multiple channels? Like, this is an insane opportunity, but I had to. Whatever little bit of integrity I have left in myself, and again, we're all human. We all make mistakes. Am I a martyr? Have I done silly things in my time? Of course I have. I've made huge mistakes with people and relationships. But whatever integrity I have left, I had to make a stand. And I made a commitment to my team at the time that I would take care of them, regardless of what happened. And I was able to shield and protect them for only so long. But again, I had nothing to lose because I knew I, work-wise, and I've grown with emotional intelligence compared to other people, I guess, that I still can compartmentalize it better, that it's work and it's not life. And I've got a family, I've got 3 kids, and I knew that I'll be okay. If I have to get a job, which means I just work and get okay money to do it, I can do that for now in interim. But I'll know I'll have no regrets. I'll know I'll be happier. I'll know I've done the right thing for a change. So I knew it was important. And I could see that there was others who couldn't do it because they needed another year on their CV to maybe get them to where they wanted to be. They're saving for a mortgage and they need 6 months of payslips to prove and get approval on a mortgage or whatever it is these days. They knew that I've just had a young kid. I can't take the risk. Whereas I was able to take a more calculated risk that whilst it's the right thing, I'll be okay.
So remember, your team is impacted. You took a stand. What happened to the rest of your team?
Five or six of them have now resigned. They're all gone. Which is a shame. Because they were a crazy bunch of individuals. And that's the great thing. We had the ability to hire and identify the right people. I was able to find, like, I didn't go through the traditional routes of HR. I went and stalked people and said, do you want to work with us? I think you've got the right minerals to do what we need to do.
How would you find them?
Stalk them on the internet.
What, just great content they're putting out? Good attitude, creative copy, what?
Totally. Like, again, to accelerate things faster, if you can find somebody who can match the tone and style of what you're doing, that's half the battle. But then trying to find somebody who's just on the cusp of being really good at what they do and potentially come become a creator and actually earn a living off it. So finding one or two of those people to do that, who I needed for that side of that, always on creative all the time. Then hiring people who were good in the reactive sense. And then I also needed really solid people who were detail-oriented and really great organizers and a little bit of strategic thinking. And bringing those together then, because they all played to their strengths and they hated every minute of it at first. They're like, they didn't understand why they were all there. They were all probably effing and blinding each other. What the fuck have I got myself
in? Sounds intense.
But we made it fun. But you could see how they get frustrated by the creative people being the worst organized human beings you'll ever meet. You know, then you have the detail oriented people who weren't helping the creative process and getting ideas out, who aren't necessarily, but like, they both educated each other in many ways, but they also eventually found out that they knew why they were there as part of a team. And when you see that moment click, it's gold. And when they all realize what they're there, the attitude, everything, it's all about the team, not about the individual. And it's absolute magic. And the fact that that's now broken apart, it's a little bit sad.
I was just going to say it is sad because you create you've clearly thought about it so succinctly and trained them. It's like a sports team almost. You've brought this unique team together.
That's, again, I learned a lot from that sort of world. But again, I still caveat it with it, guys. I could come to you tomorrow and tell you you're sacked. I could have to come and tell you your bad news, you've been made redundant. I could have to come and tell you that you're not performing the way I feel you need to perform. But I always made that clear to them. I said, I'm going to build a good culture that's fun, relentless, curious, and we will work fucking hard. But remember, I'm your manager. And remember that at some point, I'm going to have to pull rank or I'm going to have to make a decision. And that's business. And you've got to remember that.
But I think that's refreshing because a lot of people do it the other way. I'm your buddy. I'm your pal. I'm this, I'm the other. And then it's, you know, crack and banter on Tuesday and P45 Wednesday. Yeah,
it's not. I find the happy medium to do that. Even things like I won't go to Christmas parties. Like, I go to team dinners and things like that. But
God, that sounds great. I'm antisocial anyway, so that'd be a great excuse not to go.
I much prefer, sorry, this sounds great for the pod, wiping my nose. But I'm saying, like, people think, like, and even talking on these shows or doing presentations, geez, he looks like great crack. He's really fucking loud. He's obnoxious. He curses. No, the last thing, like, my social battery's fucking flat after a day's work. Nothing more I want to be is sitting home with my wife, having a glass of wine, watching Netflix, watching the series of Selling Sunset, finished it last night. Exceptional cringe TV. Married at First Sight Australia. Fucking love it. Mind-numbing, beautiful content to go. Life's not that shit when you've got dopes like that in the telly doing that sort of stuff.
I'm the same. I love this. One-to-one. This fills me up. Going to a room 100 people, completely gone. I won't engage. I'll retreat. I just can't find my way. But this fills me up. But like you said, I said that to someone last week, I was like, oh, my social battery's flat. I'm gone.
But even in that room of hundreds of people on the floor, fucking hate it beside them. Put me on a stage. That's my, like, it's almost like a comfort blanket. It means that I can be myself. But I think it's a strength of mine. I always enjoy it. I love talking about what it doesn't matter what I do. I'm curious and relentless about anything that I do. And I do love what I've done over the last few years. And whilst I love the creative side of things, there's nothing I love more talking about how we made it work.
Has it been weird? Has it been uncomfortable last few months, last few weeks, not being able to do what you do?
I kind of have been, though. Because I've been talking to so many people. Like, the amount of calls I've been on in those 3 months, it almost felt like a full-time job.
What were you doing?
It was almost like I was consulting for free for fucking way too long. I was just talking to businesses, looking at what my options are. Like, people were reaching out to me on a daily basis. I was probably on minimum, or let's say an average of 3 to 4 hours of calls every day.
Jesus.
Of potential prospects and people, and either curiously want to know what the fuck happened, or wanting to work with me, or just wanting to understand how we did it. So again, I know the power of actually talking with people can help, and it helped build my reputation. It helped get context as to what the fuck happened, and it also provided what we did it to help me navigate what next, because there were a lot of options on the table. And
like what?
Heads of social and other big brands and businesses, marketing agencies across Europe and the States coming off for me to take over departments, offers to come move to Australia to work in big brands, offers
really?
To come to the Middle East, you know, and then people suggesting and advising I do my own thing.
What was the weirdest offer you got?
Working for a fairly big competitor airline in the Middle East with the most ridiculous financial offering known to man. Like, they're just mad over there. They have so much money to spend, it's ridiculous.
Not tempted?
I was tempted, but convincing my wife and our three children to go over there. Money talks, man.
This is what the pocket money budget is going to be now, and this is what it'll be in the Middle East.
And, or how about I go on my own? I'll actually hire a full-time replica of me, or maybe AI can make me or something.
Look, if all the footballers are doing it, it kind of makes sense. It's become normalized. We tempted though, seriously. That sounds unreal.
Well, it sounds like a great opportunity, and like it would sound great as an experience for children too, but my wife's mom and dad are quite elderly, so moving right now is not an option. And we're there to support them. So I'd say that we might get itchy feet in years to come where we can do it. But I think with the decisions I'm making about my role next, I think I can do that anyway. Like I can probably go and work a month in Spain or wherever it is, or the West Coast of Clare, and still do what I do. Why? Because now I make the decisions.
So what are you going to do?
So look, after all the conversations, like most people, we're talking about consultancy, and I even hate that word, but I guess it's the right thing. But you talked about the sports environment there a minute ago. I think it's more, I'm almost becoming a coach. And there's a lot of work to be done. And I'll give you an example. Let's go on a bit of a tangent again. When I do any kind of keynote speaking events, and I think I did it in the event you attended as well, I always ask this question to the room. How many people have a documented or articulated strategy, at least on one page, that explains their why and what they're doing and how they're getting there? At max, and I did a keynote event with 800 people and a room with 100 people. No more than 3 people put their hand up in the room. And you're talking about big brands here who are in that space and in that room. And it screamed to me, okay, there's a lot of work that needs to be done here, and actually social as a whole, how it's being used because of all the pyramid scheme we've been set of content production all the time by agencies. Then the conversations I was having with people, how they were employing people, like they're paying way too much money for heads of social that aren't really heads of social in its truest form. They don't sit at the leadership table. They're not making decisions. They can't have a voice in how to actually do it better. They sit under a head of brand and they end up being this highly paid or overpaid community manager that does executional work. I was like, guys, you're wasting time and resource. That's not right. And then it's down to the process and plans. Like, they're spending way too much money on agencies where they can find better ways to do it, more effective ways, especially if they want to live in certain worlds of social. Like, take Reactive and the speed and pace that's needed in there to win. So all these things are, you know, again, there's a lot of work that needs to be done, but not in the truest sense of a consultant coming in, just talking shit and walking out. So what I've developed is a positioning piece that's built around, let's call it a 12-month program. And in that, I'll help define businesses' strategy, their why. And I'll work with them in an accelerator framework to have on a piece of paper their why and a set of guiding principles to get there. It will eventually inevitably be simple in what it's communicated, but it needs to be so everybody buys into it, the business buys into it, and the team who delivers on it or the external partners do. I'll then look at, well, what's your team dynamic and how they're set up? Is your current team fit for purpose to deliver on that? Do they need to be rechanged, reorganized? Where's the gaps? Do we need to hire? Can you hire? What can we do with what headcount and resource you have? Help them make that, navigate that decision, find those people, because I think that's a skill that I have. I can find good talent to deliver on a specific type of strategy. Then it's, well, how do we actually deliver it? And the problem with a lot of consultancy or whatever advice is given, a strategy is only as good as its execution. And that's where most of it fails. And I don't want that. That's my reputation at the end of the line. And I don't want to be, oh, I could sell strategies for 10, 20 grand, whatever it is, hustle like the rest of them, but and let it fall flat and write off. But that's not going to prove good work is good work. So what I want to do is I want to be able to roll up my sleeves and I mentioned the head of social, the overinflated thing that mightn't be the right choice for the majority of business right now. But what you'll get with me then is essentially like a temporary lead. I'll roll up my sleeves and I come in as like a part-time leader.
And that's so a fractional, almost a fractional.
Bingo.
Head of
I've heard that language been used recently. I think it's an
extra, it's all the rage. It's all the rage. It's so hot right now. So yeah. Call yourself fractional. You'll charge an extra 20% for that.
Fractional market share. I'll just.
Yeah.
But with that, it allows them to get the experience, the knowledge, and the navigation of how to do the right thing, find the right people, and then put the processes and plans in place that's right for them. Mm. And by the time that's done after a year's period of time, test, learn, adapt, coach, develop, and those people that you hire at a midweight level who are more executional, they also then have a path. They're being coached by me. They become your leaders when I run out the door and I hand over the keys and I ride off into the sunset, and you should never want me again. Imagine somebody talking like, you want to do work so well that you're no longer needed. But that's the role of a consultant. Like a good consultant should no longer be needed if you're still around the business.
That's the exact opposite of what consultants do. But anyway, yeah.
Anyway.
They just make you so dependent. You're like the junkie coming back for more. Like, so you can't get rid of them because you don't know what to do really, but you're afraid to plug it out.
Even Amazon made an interesting series on it. That was fucking great. But essentially, that's the offering on what I'm doing. But is there an opportunity to grow after that? There is. And like when I looked at the options and looked at it, could I go and do it on my own? I could. But I'm really shit at certain things. And operating and organizing a business, like you've had people on here like Pat Phelan and Ray Nolan, like fucking mad geniuses on how you fucking do this, and like obsessive in knowing and building everything.
It's a great word. Yeah, it is.
You know, whilst I'm obsessive, I know and I'm very self-aware of what I'm really, really bad at. And the thoughts of setting up a business is appealing, but you need to know everything about it. And I feel that that would take away from what I do know and what I'm good at. And going alone was probably the wrong thing to do. So with conversations, I was talking to a couple of old chums of mine in my old agency days, Dave Connor and Niamh Haughey, who set up an agency called Frank and Bear right at the start of COVID, the mad feckers. And they've kind of been navigating and growing that over recently. And they came to me with a really interesting proposition of how we do it. We set up a separate consultancy where you run, operate, it's your own thing. But then we have a sister agency where I can get the best set of Dave and Eve from business op, business growth, the setup and the operating needs that they already have that they can help that I'm really, really shit at. But also they have pay performance and studio capabilities that if there's a time where all of these beautiful people I work with and fix their internals, I can help solve potentially as an option the external side, the execution side and time if that's needed. And then that creates something that has a bigger picture that can grow more. And essentially the consultancy helps grow the other business. So obviously there's a great kicker for them, but there's a bigger kicker for me. And there are two people I adore as well.
That's a win-win. That's actually nice to hear people talk about a win-win.
Like, oh, completely. But that's business. And we all
have a lot of people don't say it that way.
But we all want to win. And like, again, working alone can be quite lonely, I imagine. And that'd be tough. Like, especially in difficult situations. You can see how a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with mental health, with their physical health, because of they give it everything.
It's an addiction almost. You said an obsession, an addiction as well. Yeah.
So at least going on the journey with a couple of people can make it a bit more fun, and you can lean on them in better ways.
So you're starting that right now?
Starting that right now. So the consultancy has been called Frankly. Frankly for a reason, because I want to be very unfiltered, direct and honest when it comes to how to use the platforms. I will come in as a guide and won't hold back and make some honest assumptions and give you some honest clarity on how you need to be using the platforms better. And it's a sister company then to Frank and Bear. So obviously the language and the lettering from a branding side of things works well, but as an entity and a word of what I want to be, it rings true to who I am and my approach to how I work.
Well, let's do a Frank review of the platforms, right? Mm-hmm. Twitter. Give me your 2 cents on each one.
Again, it's hard. It's still going to survive. Like, again, it's like
X. Sorry, whatever X, you
want
to call it.
Who cares what you call it? Like, we can call it purple monkey dishwasher if we want. But like, there's a time where it's probably going to fall its way out. But again, Musk can surprise us. Anybody could surprise us. They could have a reemergence. So it's not dead until it's literally the plug is pulled. It's still a huge opportunity for many, and it's still a reference point for so many people to get breaking news and information. And it is that source. Threads could have been that. They had to go to market early. However, it's not available in Europe. Why the hell did they do it? You know,
Threads is dead, right?
No. Yes and no. it's still being used, but it's been used by a lot of brands in a very branterish way. It's almost like that.
Branterish.
Oh, corporate banter. I fucking hate it. When you see other brands engage with each other on the internet, that makes me fucking sick. They think it's great. It probably makes a great screenshot that goes in the PowerPoint in the Weekly Report.
I think it worked once or twice and then they all thought it was a great idea.
Oh, but now they all do it all the fucking time. And it's just, it's cringe and they think it works. But I'd say most of the genuine people they're trying to reach are ignoring every amount of it. But Threads has a potential. And there's a couple of reasons why it has a potential. It is the replica of Twitter. So as a functionality, it's almost there. The problem is that X is still alive. It's going to take whiles to migrate. It's also interesting that Threads is understanding how the creator-led economy is becoming even more important and how important that when you build a following, most social media platforms, if they go belly up overnight, which is the fear X or Twitter had, you lose your audience. So imagine for Ryanair, almost 800,000 followers or more, I don't even know what the number is now. And overnight that goes to pot. You lose that. You've got to start again. So all the time and effort, money and resource you put into that, you lose it. So at least what I like about what Threads are doing is you can now get and people subscribe and get permission to take their email and you can bring that audience with you no matter where you go. So that's incredibly valuable. So I do see people will still invest. The problem on this side of the world is it's not available in Europe.
What's the crack with that? Why isn't it still available? GDPR thing?
It could be. I don't know the ins and outs. We actually got early access to it. Like we used an app, an APK. Is that what they call the app bypassers?
Oh, the VPNs.
Yeah. Well, it's not even that. I think it's like an APK thing where you can download.
Oh, the developer tools.
Yes. To actually download it. Yeah. So we had it live for a week and we are actually doing some fun stuff until most people figured out and blocked all the accounts that did it. But I don't know. I think it's a policy issue. And it's going to, like, that's, to me, that slowed down the score. I understood that they had to make a move. And, like, the US.
Well, Twitter X was weak.
At its weakest, they needed.
Could we kill it here? We probably could. They had a massive spike. But then I think if you don't get that spark, though, I think if you don't get that. Like,
I think it'll have they'll figure it out.
You think it'll be a resurgence? You think it'll come good?
I think it will 100% be a resurgence. Okay. Its connection to Instagram and its ability to migrate the followers immediately was just a genius move.
Okay. 2 cents on Instagram.
Instagram, great. They're figuring it out. They're trying to cater. They went too crazy down the route of video led and they lost its identity of what it was, which is an image sharing platform. It's such a big ecosystem that they have enough content and enough different feeds to cater to so many different needs of consumption. So I think it'll survive. It's actually getting better. Some of the policies they're bringing out, the broadcast channels, it's increasing its actual offering, which makes it a great place to create and engage and deliver content. So it's still a very rich space. The problem is so many people are just using it incorrectly.
Right. TikTok.
TikTok, I think it's reached a saturation point right now. Like, again, people are going to struggle to win in that space. It's like this life cycle of a social media channel. Channels are set up, becomes this place. The startup at the time needs to find as many audience users to use the platform as quickly as possible. They need an audience base. Then they invite brands. We're going to give you all this lovely organic reach with all these people to encourage the brands to come across. Then they go, shit, we need to make money for our investors. So, okay, now we need to start doing advertising. Great. So now we've the audience. Now we've got the brands. Let's set up ads. Let's get money in. And we're going to penalize those brands' reach now in order for them to actually start buying advertising. And now we start creating a cycle. TikTok is kind of at that moment. They're at the moment where they built the audience, became this beautiful space. They're giving free reach and moments of virality for so many brands and so many people. Then they brought in advertising. Now they're starting to penalize it. But also because there's so many brands on. It's a bit like fucking podcasting. Everyone has a podcast now. And it's so saturated, it's difficult to win.
Ouch.
I know. I told you, no bullshit. I'm going to speak frankly. That it's difficult to cut through. So like now TikTok is becoming this space where it's an even greater challenge to win organically. Can you still? Yes. Once you have an interesting angle, an interesting hook, know how to work the content. But it's tough work. Most brands don't do it. They're trying to do what they do on Instagram and do on other channels and do it on TikTok and it's failing. Or they see a big green owl or a talking airplane and think that's how you win. And they try to replicate it and fail. And it's become even more challenging for them. I think it's a great space. They're evolving good product there too from an e-commerce point of view. So as a platform and an entity, if you take the learnings from what they've done in China is it WeChat and others? It's incredibly, incredibly strong. One thing I will call out as a bit of a Trojan horse, though, is CapCut. Now, again, no science to back this up. This is anecdotal observation.
CapCut is their editing app.
CapCut is TikTok's editing app, but it's more than just an editing app. They've brought in so much of the functionality from TikTok where you can follow creators who make templates. You can comment on their content. You can engage and you can DM. So the functionality of TikTok is built into CapCut. They also have a pro option where you can pay for it to get access to better features on the actual product. So that's one way of generating revenue.
So what is it? What is it? Trojan Horse for?
Trojan Horse for. It's going to be another new social media app for a younger generation, your Gen Alphas. I hate using the terminology, but why do I observe? Parents of kids, and they know of TikTok. They're too young to use TikTok and they're too young to get internet access. But most young children have been given tablets from the age of 4 or 5 years of age up to the age of 10 now. But what parents are allowing them to do is to download CapCut because they can use the filters, they can use the templates and make video content. But they are getting access to the internet at home through their broadband because they're playing other things. But they're all engaging, following, sharing their templates on CapCut. And to me, it's like, it's almost like this transition that that's going to be a platform in itself for that younger generation of the future. And it's also going to be their entry into TikTok.
So this is your Gary V-esque prediction right here.
Kind of.
CapCut is going to be the one.
I might be talking absolute bullshit, but it's observing as a dad of three young children, a 7 and an 8-year-old who are using CapCut with their friends. All they do is talk about that. The other thing they use a lot as well is Snapchat.
And Snapchat, that's still going.
It's going to have, to me, is another resurgence.
Oh,
but,
wow.
But not as a content creation platform. It's a direct response tool for young people. And even like Gen Z's.
So communication, what do you mean? A messaging app or what?
Like WhatsApp for them.
Okay.
And they're using the filters as a fun way to create content to engage with each other in DMs. Most kids are using it as they're using their parents' number that's connected to the account, but they're contacting their friends who are parents. They say they're friends' parents. And they're all using that. So it's Snapchat and CapCut, these two apps that have kind of been used for different ways are now being used for different means for different audiences. And this younger generation are naturally going to grow with that. So you could see a re-emergence of Snapchat. But again, Snapchat for the last number of years has always been this DM chat for the Gen Z audience. WhatsApp's too uncool for them. They use Snapchat to DM for years and years. The younger generation are doing it too because the parents have control, kind of, but they're getting permission to contact their friends through that environment. And they're there's features and functionality within it that is allowing them to make content. And CapCut's similar.
There are two apps I weren't even going to ask you about. Now, your favorite app, social media of all, LinkedIn. Hit me.
Oh, LinkedIn is great, but it's just full of shit. And like, it's just corporate bollocks. Like, but again, like we chat about it. It has a huge reach potential if you find the right angle to do it. But again, like, take for example, Ryanair, I think had 600,000 people following on LinkedIn, but we never scratched that. It was something we were going to look at a moment in time, but it wasn't a priority on our list. But again, it's always an opportunity. It's a big space to play. It will have its day. It will, like, again, saturate. But right now it's a saturation of really shit, stupid updates and really shit carousels of the same regurgitated content all the bloody time. There's an opportunity to own and have an identity and build something quite strong for individuals and for businesses in that space. But everyone's just trying to be too professional there.
I am delighted to announce X. I am delighted to announce Y.
Oh, that's it. I'm delighted that I'm finishing my official last day in my current role, and here's some home truths about it.
Do you know what I hate, right? People are like, I just had such a fun time with the rock stars at insert tech company. It's always a tech company. Insert tech company here. And you're like, Michael, John, they fired you. Like, don't call them rock stars.
No.
There's a lot of that.
Of course there is. But again, people need to get past that. And it's a bit like most other channels, like Instagram. Instagram was this channel that had to be perfect and polished. Now it's going through its evolution of, yes, it's a bit of that, but now they want real content and they're rewarding real, authentic content.
So you think Instagram's coming back? That'd be your pick?
Instagram never left. I think it's just, it's an incredibly powerful channel. To me, it's a very strong channel for most people across any demographic, any category, any type of brand or business that they can maximize the most potential. TikTok also. And then it's down to where your audience are. And then it's down to, well, do you have any money? Because if you're, depending on who you are, small business, big business, your life cycle of your brand, your time and resource of people versus money has a huge influence on how you use the platforms. It depends. That will always be where I'll get to. And I'll give you an example. A friend of mine runs a kind of perfume company, but it's more around the sanitization, but better quality premium products like that, like hand sanitizers that smell absolutely delicious. Like your man Garen on the, I'm delicious. but like, she's like, I want to do social, but I see everybody documenting their story 24/7 a day. But I'm like, but you make your product. You can't.
Yeah.
If you don't make the product, you've nothing to sell. You can't scale. So you can't really be that type of person on the internet. However, if you try to pay for someone, I'm not sure if that's the right role either. But if you even have some sort of investment, well, there's a way that you can make really interesting creative about your brand and about converting people and use paid media, whatever amount you have, and still reach 100x of what you normally do and let it automate and actually use social in a way that's right for you right now based on your time, resource and budget and what you need. Because in your early stages, you need to sell product and you need people to be aware of it. So it always depends and it always goes, where are the audience? How can you do it?
What brands do you like? What brands do you follow? And you're like, they're absolutely killing it.
Oh, that's so
hard. Or even creators, because I know you're very big in the creator economy. What creators are you watching? What brands are you watching?
It's so hard. Like, again, do you like brands? Does anybody like a brand? I don't know. I always get asked this and I always have fucking really shit answers. I love the Washington Post on social media. I think they've modernized the media, the approach to media and newscasting in the world of social in a very clever way. TikTok, they got their creators to explain that it's normally complex things in a way that was relatable to Gen Z. Other brands that do a really good job.
That's symptomatic of the industry though, if that's what you're
saying. But again, it is. Like, again, I love what I did because I did the right thing. Gymshark. I think Gymshark is a brand. How they've evolved and used social is exceptional. Like Ben Francis in his early days didn't have a pot to piss in. He was a startup business. But he knew he had product. He put the product in the hands of people who were influential and he got people to wear it and he stimulated awareness. He stimulated trial.
Class story.
And then he started to build it. They eventually used that and there was an integral part of building their community and building low cost, high return reach on social media. Use it very, very effectively with ambassador people over time. But then he exploded. Now he's worth a billion valuation. But they've now decided to do less of that and focus more on other methods of marketing because now they have the capital, the resource, the time and invest. So
why switch tactic? Do you have to? Do you reach a saturation point?
Well, you probably do. And it's just based on time, resource and budget. It's not the most effective thing to do to reach scale.
Okay.
Now they're at a business where they have a switch on community. So they will nurture and develop a lot of that, but not at the level or the volume it needs to be. But now they need to reach far more low engaged users to sell more product.
Okay.
And there'll be an expectation and a scalability needed. And then you have to think about how you do that. Paid media is probably going to, based on your investment and your resource and your budget, probably going to reach far more people than one or that organic play can do. And then you've got to think about the behaviors and motivations of how they consume that media and the moments of purchase. And all that. So it's too complex and it's too difficult to answer very simply what that is. So I love what Gymshark do, but even on their TikTok, and I binged on their TikTok, I think about 3 or 4 weeks ago for 40 minutes. Because they found this angle of humor that they tapped into their audience so, so well in a way that is just so genius that it's starting to perform. I think they went through a period where they did really well, they saturated and then it dropped and they tried to find, but their team unearthed it and they tested and they learned, they found a way to deliver an angle around gym bro culture that created this really interesting dark humor that resonates with so many people within that audience. That's just absolutely mind-blowing. I think what they do on far other channels, their campaign, their responsive nature to what they do on the internet is exceptional. I love them as a brand as well. I love the story, but I think they do really, really good work. Like there are a lot of brands that do okay work, but I feel they could do much better.
Now they know how. I'm going to leave you two questions. 2024, what social things are you looking at? What are you kind of like going, yeah, that could be a big one. I know you've teased it there with CapCut. What are you looking at?
The biggest challenge, I think, is the audience ownership. Like, I think the whole X situation has scared the shit out of everybody that we're investing so much in building audiences that we don't own. The platforms own them. And if they turn off, we lose them all. So moving and owning audience is something to think about. And
moving them to where?
Wherever you need to go, wherever you need to own them, however you need to nurture them. You know, reach is really important in marketing. But like what these followers or what you're doing is it becomes a concern. I don't, like, to me, for now, reach will always be the most important metric on social right now. But the concern is losing that audience overnight. So again, it's not 2024's conversation, but it's something that's on my mind.
So email, where?
Email, more than likely. It's the only one that I can see at the moment. And you're looking at other ways where maybe the metaverse or wallets or whatever it is, you can put them in and carry them. So it's too long away. So it's not a big concern, but it's on my mind. 2024, I think it's just about delivering better work on the platforms. And I guess that's my focus right now and what I want to do. And there's clearly a lot of work to clear up the bullshit, because social media is not black and white. And if anybody tells you that there's only one way to do it, they're talking through their bloody arsehole, and you need to stop following the snake oil merchants when it comes to that. There are so many ways to use the platforms that my focus for 2024 is to try and find as many businesses to make the best decision possible to have some sort of culture or impact, to educate their C-suite better at understanding the platforms. We all know the opportunity what social media channels can bring in terms of reaching people, but there's multiple ways you can do that. And I want to go on the journey of trying to find people's why. And I know it sounds wafty and bullshit, but it's about making better decisions that have some sort of impact. Because if you're not, and you're doing next year the same thing every corporate brand is doing, and that is just becoming wallpaper and just a sea of sameness, it's the biggest waste of money.
It's becoming like ads in the newspaper now. You don't even see them anymore. You're flicking through a magazine. You do not even see them. Your eyes just scan through.
And there's big brands spending hundreds of thousands of euro every year on this. And they're just dabbling and ticking a box and doing these.
But it's like you say, everyone has a metric. Oh, did you hit the print metric? Yeah. Did you hit the Instagram metric? Yeah.
So I want to fix people's shit is essentially my focus for 2024. There's no real big dramatic change on the platforms.
Okay.
There's just
doing, thinking about getting more control, ownership and just getting and
doing
more
better
creative.
Work and making better decisions to actually use the channels to have impact or at least some form of culture.
Final bit of advice to every... I know you love talking to founders. That's your passion.
Fucking founders.
What's your bit of advice to any entrepreneur, business owner, someone who's just out there hustling? What's your final bit of advice to them?
Oh, Jesus Christ, I don't know. Fuck, I'm not some sort of Steve Bartlett guru bullshit. So now again, I love and hate Steve Bartlett. So don't get me wrong. Hi, Stephen.
I'm meeting him next week. I'll tell him you pass on your regards.
There you go. Look, it probably cost you 25 grand to go see him, but nonetheless, no, I do love
him. I'll tell you after.
I think what he's doing is great. But any advice? I don't have advice. Again, just don't be a dickhead. I think it's like the no dickheads rule. I think Toto Wolff did it on another podcast, and he said the one rule, and I love it. And I met another founder of a really great company that you should get on, is the CEO of OneSonic. So OneSonic is a new headphone brand that is based in Ireland, created by an Irish guy who's a background in...
I'll get you to intro me right after this.
Audio engineering. He is an absolute genius. He's created an insane product, and he's found this gap in the market where it's the barrier between the high performance audio equipment and the low range cheap shit you can buy on Amazon. And he's created this amazing product for an affordable price. And I feel if he gets the right backers, it's going to absolutely explode. But he added to that no dickheads rule. So I'll build on that. He said to me, and I fucking love it, is it no dickheads and no fucking pussies. And I know it's a bad language word to use, but fuck it, I don't care. But what he's saying is correct. You don't need to be a dickhead to be good in business, but you also, we have to have less snowflakes. And that's the fear of the generations that are coming through. We need to be a little bit more hardier and a little bit more resilient and a little bit more relentless.
And I think people are trying to go on one side of the line. Which are you? But you don't have to be either.
But it's
you
also
can just be yourself. Be sound.
And there's a huge playground of an amount of really good people that sit between both of those. Find those people, play in that space. Don't be a dickhead, but don't be a pussy.
Immense. Michael, where can people learn a bit more about you and Frankly?
Well, you can go to the professional site, LinkedIn. I'm currently working on the branding and the setup, but I'll have a website set up soon. So it'll be a bit of a landing page to explain what I've done, where to contact me, and join my waiting list because I've got lots of work. But find me on LinkedIn, search Michael Corcoran, find me on Twitter X at Le Machine. Long story why I'm called at Le Machine. That's a college nickname. We don't need to go there.
Michael, that was savage.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.